history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are people around you with stories to tell. Maybe you drive by and see their holiday decorations this time of year, but you have no idea what kinds of things they've been through on our behalf. And you never will unless you take a little time to ask and have the patience to listen as they start to open up a bit. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that has been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we're always educated, we're always entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. With the holidays upon us, I thought it was an opportunity for us to pick up a little perspective. As you gather with your family this Christmas, how about pausing just for a moment to consider our men and women in uniform who aren't able to make it home for the holidays because they're answering the call of duty around the globe. During World War II, there were millions of Americans in uniform who found themselves in places on Christmas that they never would have imagined on those childhood mornings waking up early to check their stockings. Often, if we're thinking of Christmas in World War II, the first thing that comes to mind is the Battle of the Bulge, which began December 16, 1944, and lasted well into the new year. Over the years here on Hometown Heroes, we've heard from dozens and dozens of American servicemen who spent their Christmas there in the coldest European winter in decades, participating in a battle that would see more than 20,000 Allied soldiers killed and more than 40,000 wounded. For those who survived the Bulge, every Christmas in the 74 years since brings back those vivid memories. But there are World War II Christmas stories well beyond the Bulge, and we're going to explore three of those today, starting with Joe Goicoechea, who had left Boise, Idaho to work in a remote spot in the Pacific called Wake Island. He wasn't even officially in the military at that point. He was one of 1,100 men working on Wake for the Morrison Knudsen Construction Company when the Japanese attacked 77 years ago.
Well, Honolulu, it was hit at 7:57 in the morning. We were hit 4 hours later at 11, but we was across the international dayline of December the 8th for us. December the 7th on the other side.
But did you hear about what happened at Pearl Harbor before the Japanese hit you?
Well, we heard a few hours before, but we figured we'd have some help. And then we had a Pan American Airways plane in the lagoon, and it took off for Guam or the Philippines. And then pretty soon, half hour or not, they come back and let the gas out and landed. And it wasn't long after that, all hell broke loose. Japs come in from the sun, and they wasn't very high, and they dropped their loads and so forth. And we had 12 fighter planes there, and I think 8 of them were hit. The pilots were in there, too.
And where were you, and how did you witness all this?
Peel Island. We were building a bomb-proof powerhouse. We were just getting ready to get on the truck to go to the mess hall on Wake to eat, and then that's when all hell broke loose.
And for those who aren't familiar with the layout, tell us where Peel Island is in relation to Wake.
We had a bridge there, about 100 meters bridge, that brought Wake with Peel. Then on the other side was Wilkes Island. But they were building a passage for the submarines to come in. So those people had to go by boat across the little channel there to go to Wilkes. But they seen a lot of action, too.
So you think you're taking a lunch break, and all of a sudden you're at war.
Yeah, all hell broke loose. And then we was all confused, and I never did hear what Mr. Teeter said, but I was told that the guys at the camp on Wake by the mess halls, and of course I was on the other island, he told them that everybody was on their own and go out in the brush, and if they needed people, they would come and get them, which they didn't. So I don't know. There was a lot of confusion among our people, too, the brains and so forth.
So what was going through your mind? You're 20 years old. You're halfway around the world from any kind of family or anybody that you have a real good relationship with, and now all of a sudden you're on your own against the Japanese.
Well, it was trying to overcome the shock. I tell you, the first day, that night, that was all held. Really shocked, you know, and all, but I leveled out since afterwards, and I volunteered a lot for different things, and in the end, they was going to hold back 300 men. There was 1,165 of our guys. I think around 300 Marines, 68 Navy, 6 Army with a Captain Wilson. They had the communications between the gun positions and so forth. They asked for volunteers. They needed about 300 men to stay with the Marines, and I volunteered to stay. But the guy was over me, Superintendent Iron and everything, he and I didn't hit it off, and we had a few words, and he said, I had a meeting today with the officers, and your name's on there to stay. And I said, I got one better on you. I already volunteered.
Yeah. Why did you volunteer?
At my age, if I went back to States, I'd been inducted into some force, and I don't know where I end up. I may not even come out alive. So it's just one of those facts in life that you have to say yes or no to and don't have much time to think.
And I think your situation is different from a lot of the veterans that I talked to, because a lot of them were about what your age was at the time. They're 18, 19, 20, but everyone they're serving with is the same age. You had gone over with these contractors, and as you said, a lot of them were older than you. So you have guys twice your age, 40s, 50s, that are fighting next to you, huh?
They were experienced men in their trades and so forth, and being bad times in the country here, a lot of them went over and got made good pay, money, and had good conditions. I was fortunate enough to be in the barracks with some journeymen iron workers and carpenters and so forth, and I had one particular iron worker foreman spend sometimes the evening teach me how to read the plans and so forth, and I carried on the rest of my life doing that.
But for a while, you didn't know if there was going to be a rest of your life. After you volunteered to fight the Japanese there, what kinds of things did you do? Were you on a gun? What were you doing?
No, moving 3-inch guns mostly, anti-aircraft guns. And then when you move the guns, you got to sandbag them. You got to protect them. And you got to have protection for the men because they're not right on the gun all the time. They're away, and then you have jobs of carrying the ammunition. And that's a full-time job, too.
And you got to make sure you don't get hit by the incoming either, right?
You got to be careful. And we suffered a lot of casualties, and I don't know. I was pretty fortunate. That second day, we had hit awful hard. We was on Peel. We just moved some guns from one end of Peel to another end, and we got hit during the day at noon. I was covered with blood. I was evidently knocked out a little bit, and I was laying on a guy, and he says, you're hit. Couldn't feel nothing. I looked over there, and he had a big hole in his back. And I said, Ernie, you're the one that's hit. Then he panicked a little bit. And then to the right of me, about 6 or 8 feet, there's another guy. And he had a bullet right through his head. We had a lot of people around us that was killed or wounded. All we had, we just did what we could to help one another and get along. But the hospital was on the wake right across the lagoon, and it was hit. And they needed help bad. Me and the sergeant, Marine Sergeant Ken Marvin from Gig Harbor, Washington, we went over there. I don't know how in the hell, and he was hit in the head and had a rip in his head, piece of metal there. And we went over there, and a lot of bodies, pieces of body, leg, arm, what have you.
You described this, seeing your friends wounded, seeing your friends killed, seeing pieces of bodies lying left and right. It doesn't sound very encouraging for your own prospects. How did you get through? What did you focus on to get yourself through the next day, the next hour, the next minute?
We had a routine of moving guns, and we had to furnish our own food. We had to find out where the catches were and bring them into our dugouts. And I happened to know where a few of them were, and I had a couple guys, older journeyman iron workers, go with me. I drove the truck because them Jap bombers and the Zeros that come in. And so I hit a pretty good place, loaded up with canned milk and fish and meat and whatever. So we had a lot of stuff.
You talked about going with Marvin to the hospital. What were the extent of your injuries?
Well, most of mine was my head. I was falling down, dizzy, and bleeding quite a bit from mouth and nose, but I did. Well, I had coral hits on me. Coral, the wake is all coral.
Yeah.
And coral is bad as shrapnel.
So a bomb hits the coral sprays everywhere and cuts you to pieces.
And I had a few of those on me and this and that, but after you're so long and you got so much going through your mind, you don't feel a lot of stuff, you know, until you settle down and get your marbles back. And then you go look for some medic or somebody can help you a little bit.
So did you stay in the hospital or did they put you back out there?
No, the hospital was blown, gone. So we had some facilities there we built, concrete bomb shelters and stuff to store ammunition. They used those for hospitals, and they had some underground stuff we dug out with our equipment, heavy equipment, and they used them for hospitals. And we only had two doctors there. We had a doctor with us and a Navy doctor. But we had a lot of medics on our side, and then the Marines had some corpsmen. There's a big difference between a medic and a corpsman. You never want to call a medic a corpsman.
They don't like that very much.
No, because they probably 5 or 6 years becoming one, and a medic might just be 6 or 8 weeks, you know. So anyway, they did a good job taking care of people.
And at the time, you don't know how long this is going to last. You don't know if you're going to win or lose.
We heard, this is all scuttlebutt, this is what we heard from Marines, there was a force coming in from the Hawaiian Islands. It was bringing more airplanes, more Marines, more equipment, more everything. And the admiral in charge of it, I forgot his name, is Pew or Pooh or something like that. He bought 400 or 500 miles away, and he backed out.
That's Admiral Pye, who had a couple carriers, Saratoga and Lexington, headed toward Wake, but called them off because he thought that they might sail into a trap. Some others, like Admiral Bull Halsey, thought that was a big mistake.
He was pretty well teed off at this other guy because he figured that, and he was right. If they come in when that guy could have, they could have brought more reinforcements, got more help, and maybe we could have held off the Japs a little longer.
So you guys ended up, like those on Bataan and Corregidor, as prisoners of the Japanese. But how did that happen? When did you realize that your side was not going to win this battle on Wake Island?
I never did give it that thought. I always figured we'd be evacuated or there'd be more troops come in, more help, you know. December the 8th, we was hit. December the 23rd, we gave in. And we knew around 22nd or 23rd that it was getting close because they said, boy, the ships will be here in 24 hours or something. It never would show up. So after a while, you just gave up on it.
And I'm sure you never had contemplated spending Christmas as a prisoner of war.
They took us to the airport, all of us. They had machine guns around us and all, and we thought, well, this is it, you know. And we wasn't in too good a shape. I wasn't, in a way, and a lot of other guys worse than me. What we were told later, that the Japanese got orders from Tokyo to not to kill us. So then on Christmas Day, 24th or 25th, we all marched to our camp, the good camp that we lived, but it was the barracks and everything. It was hit pretty hard and all, but you could still go in and seek shelter, you know, from the sun and rain and so forth. And that's where we went, and then we went on detail. Japs had us go on details because they wanted to know where those Oki guns were. Oki means big in Japanese. Well, the biggest guns we had is a 5-inch. We told them none, but we went different places and found different things. We found a lot of our dead guys that crawled back in their holes and died. They were wounded, you know. And after a while, in the heat and everything, a man kind of smells a little bit. Boy, I tell you, it's terrible.
I know what happened to you from there. You were a prisoner of war until the end of the war, from the start of the war to the end of the war. If you had known that then, if someone had told you you were going to be held captive for nearly 4 years from that point, would you have believed that you could make it that long in those conditions?
No, I didn't even give it any thought.
Because you have no idea. I mean, this could go on. You could be never get out of a POW situation.
Our mentality was different. We just seemed to be full of cement. Just solidified our head was and everything. Hell, and then some of them kind of went a little nutty. And so it takes all kinds of people.
And I know you ended up in four different prisoner of war camps at the hands of the Japanese, and I know there are a lot of stories you can share from that, and I want to hear a few of them, but I'm curious, when you look at that in the big picture, when you look of surviving 44 months as a prisoner of war with very little to eat, not always treated very well, what did you think about that kept you believing you could still have a life after this? Because a lot of guys, as you said, it made them go nuts. They didn't survive. You made it through. Why was that? What was your key?
Attitude. Oh, gosh, I used to joke with the Japanese. We met some good Japanese that didn't have to be good to us. We'd tell them all kinds of stories. They asked me if I was married, and I said, yeah. And rifle. I got two rifles. And another Jap, a few days later, asked me about it and the rifle. And I said, yeah. Yeah, three or four, I tell them different stories. And they wanted to find any kids, and I said, yeah. So one time, about three or four of those Jap soldiers come over there, and ones I talked to at different times in a week or 2 week time. They looked at me and everything, shook their head and said, dummy done, nah, he's crazier than hell.
Finally figured you out, huh?
Yeah, but we, that sense of humor, that's what I feel that kept me alive. I kept going. I prayed a lot. I'm a pretty Christian. I mean, I always did pray. I was taught to pray, and I always did pray. And I feel that's the reason I'm here.
What do you pray in a situation like that?
Gosh, it's hard to tell you. You're praying for yourself, that's for sure.
Get me out of here?
Save me and this and that. And oh, you were scared of being wounded, seriously. That was it, because we had no way. We had two doctors there and the medics, but the hospital was blown up. Everything was taken out to take care of them. Had really no way to really take care of the wounded soldiers, or wounded people, I should say. God, some of them are in bad shape. A lot of them lost a leg or an arm or something.
Four different camps and 44 months as a prisoner. What would you say was the hardest thing to endure? I'm sure you didn't have very good things to eat. I'm sure you lost a lot of weight. But what was the most challenging or most threatening experience that you faced?
Well, so much. In the first year, we was in China, the prison camp there at Wusong. It was cold, icy. We had no clothes. Our feet, gee whiz, just almost cry with the pain in your feet and stuff. And it was miserable. And they gave us two blankets, each prison. You could put the blankets and see through them. Two of you get together. You put a blanket underneath on the deck, wooden deck, and then you put the others over. You never take your clothes off. If you had any other clothes, you put them all on. But that was the first winter in China.
All told, he would spend four Christmases in captivity, finally liberated in 1945 after 44 months as a prisoner of war. He wasn't in the military initially, but after the war, he was officially made a Navy veteran and awarded the Purple Heart. Joe Goicoechea passed away in December 2016 at the age of 95. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, another World War II story to give you a little holiday perspective. A gentleman who spent Christmas 1944 aboard a hospital ship after surviving a deadly typhoon. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special holiday edition of the program, reminding you that this Christmas and every Christmas, there are men and women in uniform putting themselves in harm's way to make sure that you and I have the freedom and security to gather with our families and celebrate. If we're to go back 74 Christmases, not only were those soldiers in Europe dealing with a fierce enemy and brutal weather conditions in the Battle of the Bulge, but the U.S. Navy was still taking stock of the devastating effects of Typhoon Cobra, also known as Halsey's Typhoon. That horrific storm cost the lives of nearly 800 sailors on three capsized destroyers. One of them was the USS Hull, as we hear from a then 22-year-old sailor named Pat Doohan, who had a pregnant wife back home in California.
Well, the weather started getting bad. We'd been at the States for a yard overhaul, and we stopped at Ulithi. The fleet had made one operation on the Philippines when MacArthur landed, and then we were taking out a bunch of oilers to refuel the fleet and then join the fleet. So we got out, we started refueling, and it started getting impossible to refuel. And a lot of those ships were getting real low on fuel, and the weather was getting worse and worse. And the 17th, why, they were breaking fuel lines and everything else, so they said, we just can't do it anymore. And like as a typhoon, one of the ships was out of oil, just completely out. So that's when we got into, the weather was just getting bad. And the 17th, why, it was, the waves were just unbelievable.
I mean, were you topside for any of this?
I was on the bridge most of the time.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the waves were breaking clear over the top of the bridge. We were taking, well, the waves were estimated at 65 to 100 feet high.
Ooh.
And when you're down that trough, you're looking up the top of the waves. And the wind was peaking up to putting her 200 knots. And it was just breaking these ships up. And we were taking 50 and 60-degree rolls, and we took a lot of 70-degree rolls. And stuff was being broken off the ship. And the night before we went down, it was pure havoc on the bridge. We picked up a new captain, and it was a disaster. The Kane Mutiny is something people were wondering if it was written about our ship, because we tried to get the exec to take over. It was so bad up there. But anyway, we were taking rolls 70 degrees, taking water, and we took one 80-degree roll and took water down one of our stacks and put the fires out in the forward fire room.
And for folks at home who don't understand the lingo there, if you have a 90-degree roll, then you are perpendicular to the water.
Yeah.
And your stack is parallel to the water. If an 80-degree roll, you're almost to that tipping point.
Right.
That's pretty severe.
Well, what happened, we'd take a roll like that, and then a wave underneath would push us back up.
Uh-huh.
And we knew we lost some men overboard during the night over the fantail. And I did probably a very stupid thing, or maybe it saved my life. But in the middle of the morning, I'd been on the bridge all night, and of course we didn't have any food or water or anything up there, or coffee, which is something you can't do without, but we had to do without because it's impossible to make coffee in the galley. I said, I'm going to go back and get some sack time. So being an open deck destroyer, one of the old ones, we had an open deck to the after part of the ship. Well, the ship was on a roll, and I made a dash, and I could have easily been washed overboard, but I grabbed a hold of a couple torpedoes. One of the torpedo tubes made my way into the after deck house. Then I went down, got in my sack, and I got immediately thrown out when the ship rolled. So I went up on topside in what we call the after deck house and was there with about 20 or 30 of my shipmates in that little compartment.
What did the mood seem to be on the ship? Did you see fear in people's eyes?
Fear and uncertainty. And I think on the bridge that night, it was uncertainty, and it was a fact that we had somebody that didn't know what they were doing, and the older men, they say, hey, we're in a bad place, and when the barometer drops like it did, the old sailors that were been in the Orient, they knew what we were in for. And when you're taking water and you're wanting to jettison like the whaleboat on the side, and the captain wouldn't let you, and it was finally broken away and went over the side anyway. And one of the chiefs wanted everybody to put on their life jackets. And you have the captain say, what are you doing, trying to scare my crew? Why, you know.
No, trying to save their lives.
Uncertainty. And so it was kind of havoc up there on the bridge that night. But when I got in that after deck house, why, the guys were either praying or crying or cussing.
Yeah, that pretty much runs the gamut.
Right.
Covers it all. Now, how long did this go on?
Well, it went on. I got up in the after deck house in that after part of the ship. We went over around noon. And when the ship would roll, one of the hatches was broken off and the water would come in. And then when it straightened up and go, the water would go out. And when it finally went over, I was fortunate. I had a hold of the handle on one of the hatches. And there was an air vent above. Well, I grabbed a hold of, put my foot in that air vent and hold of that handle. But I couldn't get the hatch open. Here, water was coming up. Well, the latches on the hatch, or we call them dogs, they're kind of big handles. A lot of my shipmates had a hold of those. And there's no way, I had to kick their hands off. That still bugs me today, because I had to kick their hands off. They dropped down in the water in order to get that hatch open. I don't know how many of those survived. I mean, it just...
Even though none of them could have gotten out unless you did that,
none of them,
you don't know if they made it or not.
I don't know. I know some of them made it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got the hatch open, it came back on my back, and several scooted out and didn't come back and pull it off of me. Finally, one fella did, and I was meaty, and I had no life jacket.
So you were almost trapped in there by the hatch itself.
Right. And I had no life jacket. My life jacket was on the bridge. I left it up there all night. And it had a flashlight and a whistle on it, which we were issued. And so when I came out of there...
Hold on, I don't want to get in the way of... And I know you've got this memorized up here, but I just want to dwell on this for a second. So you pull the hatch open, but the pressure of the water pins you. The hatch has you pinned. You can't move, right?
Can't move.
What is going through your mind at that moment?
Am I going to make it? Yet, I never gave up hope. That's something that I just had. I never gave up hope. By then, I'd come back to the States one time. One time we came in for a short visit. I got married. I married the girl I was going with before the war, Fresno girl. And she was pregnant when we left after our yard overhaul, which... 13 other wives were that I knew of. Only three of us came back. Anyway, I had hope. I knew that I just couldn't give up.
You had a wife and a baby you hadn't met.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Expecting a baby.
Uh-huh.
But, there's one thing that I think helps. I had a lot of faith from above, plus the fact I was a swimmer.
Mm-hmm.
And the water itself doesn't bother me. The elements, but the water itself.
Did it seem like an eternity before someone came and pulled that hatch off you?
It seemed like an eternity. And when I came out of there, like I said, I didn't have a life jacket, but there was one spare life jacket tied to a gun. And somebody up there put it there for me, and I slipped it on. And I was immediately washed up midships, then washed clear of the ship.
Now, when you say somebody put it there, do you mean one of the fellow sailors put it there?
Somebody up above put it there.
It was divine intervention.
Right.
Was there any reason for it to be there?
They usually had several extra life jackets tied to guns around there, but why that one was there at that one spot.
So you come through the hatch.
I came out the hatch, and the ship was on its side at that time.
Uh-huh.
And
can you see? What can you see? Can you see anything?
You see the whole side of the ship all the way up to the... It was over on its side, and I got washed up midships. And then another wave. Then about that time, one of my shipmates, one of those big old life jackets, had him jammed against the side of the ship, and we couldn't get to him to pull it off. And the last thing I remember, he raised his fist in the air and yelled, "Fight on." He was a Pearl Harbor survivor, and he was one of the greatest guys on ship, but his favorite words was, "Fight on." And that's the last I saw him.
Hmm.
We couldn't break it loose.
But you were able to get that life jacket on.
I totally, yes.
And then how did you get off the ship, or did the ship take care of that for you?
The ship took care of that. I was washed free of the ship. And I was out there, and there was a lot of sailors in the water, and there was life jackets or life rafts around. And I grabbed a hold of one big life raft, but it was tied to another life raft. And these big, huge life rafts when they would bang together, I saw some of my shipmates' heads pop open like popcorn.
Ugh.
And I let go immediately. And then a wave came up between me, and I didn't see anybody from then on. I didn't feel the ship going down on my body. I mean, you could just feel the, when it hit the depth, why you could feel, you know, feel exploding. And
did it disappear from your view pretty quickly?
Yes, it went down. And pretty soon, all of a sudden, I felt like I was being sucked down deep and deep. And being in the middle of a task force, I didn't, you know, and you couldn't see. The rain was so fierce, it was just cutting your face if you looked into it. And all I could think of, I'm being drawn into the propellers of another big ship going by. And you could just think, I mean, you're just drawn deeper and deeper down at the depths, and there's no way of stopping it. And you fear that, and then all of a sudden you're shot to the surface. Well, after that happened twice, I realized I was going up a wave, and one of the top crests of the waves was breaking over me and shoving me down.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, I'd double up when that would happen, and it would hurt my ears, but it only happened a couple more times.
We think about the movie Titanic or something like this, and you see the people calmly floating and watching all the devastation around them. You're still in the middle of a typhoon, and the rain is cutting into your face. So what is going through your mind at the time? What are you trying to do?
Well, trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
The typhoon hadn't hit its peak until we'd been in the water for about an hour or so. And so we're right in the middle of it. And after I got away from that life raft that we're banging together, why, I was alone. And pretty soon the storm started a little bit subsiding, and it was getting darker. And here I was, can you imagine being out in the middle of South Pacific in just a life jacket, all alone and getting dark?
No, thank you. Oh, yeah, and then there's those things called sharks.
Sharks and barracuda that you worry about. Well, the storm had subsided, and I was alone, and I didn't see anybody. And all of a sudden, something hit me in the back of the neck. And I was terrified. I thought, I'm going to be hit by a shark. Well, I reached back and grabbed it. It was dark then. I reached back and grabbed it, and it was a broom from the wreckage. And it was put there for a reason. You know, hours floating right there, why, your legs get pretty numb. So I was able to hold the broom between my hands and rest my feet on the shoulders of that broom and raise them up. So the broom was there for a reason.
Sent to you by the same person who left the life raft with the gun.
Right.
The man upstairs.
Man upstairs. And I continued floating, and I saw a big searchlight. I said, oh, boy, somebody knows the ship went down. And I saw that searchlight going back and forth, and pretty soon I must have been in a fast current, because pretty soon I was over the horizon, and I didn't see it anymore. Later on, I found out it was a Tabor. It was also pretty near broken up DE that picked up a good number of my shipmates and other off of the other ship, too.
And that was the time at which the Taborer was picking people up?
Yes. What they thought, their antenna was broken off, their mast had broken off, so when they were getting ready to repair it, they saw this little light, and they thought a man was washed overboard. So they finally maneuvered and picked him up, and he said the hull went down. And that was at 10 o'clock at night. That was the first time anybody ever knew any ship went down. And so they immediately started looking for other survivors, and they heard some of the whistles, and they started picking them up, and the next day Halsey ordered them to rejoin the fleet. But the good old captain, young captain, he disobeyed Halsey's order three times, and he picked up 56 men.
And thank the Lord he did.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if Halsey said that. But
a little later on, I was drifting, and it was dark, and I saw this little light, little bitty light like a flashlight. So we were issued one cell flashlights and a whistle to put on our life jacket, but since my life jacket was on the bridge and I had a spare one, I didn't have it. So I yelled, and they yelled, who is it? And I told them, and I made my way over to it, and they pulled me in. It was some of my shipmates on one of these big rafts with the bottom pretty near broken out of it. But I got in it with them, and I felt good about that.
But I meant that wasn't what you were hoping for when you heard someone else's voice.
No.
But that's kind of like, wow, I'm getting rescued. Oh, I'm still stuck in the ocean.
Yeah, and We were stuck there. The next morning at daylight, the first thing we saw was 12 and 14-foot sharks, dorsal fins, circling us. Every once in a while, they'd make a pass at us, you know, turn over, and they could have easily gone underneath that raft and got our legs, but they didn't. They just were biding their time, I believe.
Not to leave you in suspense, but it's break time again. When we come back, how that ordeal ended up and what special Christmas Eve moment he'd find himself remembering for the rest of his life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to this special holiday edition of Hometown Heroes, adding a little perspective to your family gathering by getting a taste of what some of our World War II veterans went through on Christmases long, long ago. We left off in December 1944 with a sailor named Pat Doohan clinging to life in the Pacific. His destroyer, the USS Hull, was one of three that had gone down in Typhoon Cobra. At this point, he was with 11 other survivors on a raft. The storm was still raging, and they had no idea whether or not they'd survive.
We could talk to each other. Two of them drank salt water and died from exposure, and we let them drift away. And you say something or say a prayer and let them go, and you know they're going to be gone. And we drifted several days, and some of the guys were going to go a little bit nuts at various times, hallucinating, and I think the last night out, pretty everybody was in that frame of mind. One fellow went outside the raft, and the shark tore his arm up, and we got him back in. The last day out, one of the fellows said, there's a bunch of ships on the horizon over there, and he pointed over there. He said, oh, you're nuts like everybody else. Well, we rubbed the salt out of our eyes, and sure enough, we saw some ships over on the horizon, just the stacks and the smoke. And about that time, two carrier airplanes came over, circling, you know, watching for submarines ahead of the fleet. And they passed over us, but, you know, they were so high up, a man looks like a little thumbnail in the ocean. But pretty soon they made a circle, and they came right down at water links, and they wiggled their wings, and we knew we'd been spotted.
They waved at you.
They waved at us, and pretty soon a big cloud of smoke went up from this fleet over there, and we knew a destroyer had lit off its boilers. And we, you know, being some destroyer men, you know, when you see that big cloud of black smoke, you know something's coming. Well, a big, beautiful USS Brown pulled up alongside of us, and they threw us a line. And when they threw us a line, started pulling over to us, the sharks went into frenzy. And they had to break out guns and just start firing to keep the sharks away from us. And so they got us up. They helped us up the rope ladder. And we got on deck. And, of course, we're macho men, you know. Nothing wrong with us. We don't need two guys on each side of us. Let go of me. Well, they let go of me. I hit the deck immediately. I needed some help.
Well, how long had you been in the water now?
Three and a half days, yeah.
Holy cow.
With no food or water. See, that the water was the bad thing. Food you can do without, but water you can't. So they took us in. The first thing they did was give us a shot of whiskey, which burned all the way down.
I imagine.
And then they gave us sips of water. I went to the Browns' first reunion a number of years ago. And the guy that gave me that sip of water wanted to have a picture taken with me, give him that sip of water. So then they... immediately, they were getting low on supplies, but they broke out their best the next day, and they gave us some food, and each guy gave up a sack for us. A little bit later on, they picked up the only six survivors from the Monahan. They were 20 minutes later, they picked those guys up. They were a good bunch of guys.
And so by this time, you've realized our ship's gone, the Monahan's gone, the Spence is gone.
We didn't know about the Spence.
Okay.
We didn't, so they, in fact, each man gave us a sack, and the fellow that whose sack I'm in, he gave up. I'm still good friends with him.
How about that?
He lives in Sacramento. We visit once in a while. But anyway, they took us into Ulithi and took us over to the Solus, one of these big hospital ships painted white with a red cross on the side of us. And like I say in the letter, Christmas Eve, we were carried on board the Solus in stretchers and the nurses singing Christmas carols. I'll never forget that.
I can imagine why that is a Christmas memory that stays with you forever. At what point did it occur to you, almost 800 men died in this typhoon, and somehow I survived? And what did you make of that? Why do you think you are one of the ones that got to come home?
There's a reason. I'm still looking for, though, there's a number of reasons, I guess. I mean, I have had a good family, I've had a good life, have a good wife, and a lot of good friends, although at our age we're losing a lot of them. Just like my shipmates, and being the reunion coordinator, we had to close it down after 22 years. But there's a reason, and I don't know.
You've been trying to figure the reason out?
I've tried to figure it out, and it saddened me to know that I lost so many shipmates. Some of them were very close to me, and on a ship like an old destroyer, while you're, except for the new fellows, we had just taken on a bunch of new fellows in Seattle, which we didn't get to know, but most of us had served several years together, and we're all very, very close, which makes it kind of rough when you're that close to a group, and you've served and done so many things together to lose them. Out of the total, there was 92 survivors off the three ships.
And that's out of almost 900 men total.
So we say we got the most. We got 62. The Spence had 24, and the Monahan had 6.
So that's fewer than 100 survivors out of nearly 900 sailors on those three ships. And just on Doohan's destroyer, there were 10 sailors who never had the chance to meet their children who were born while they were at sea.
When we left to go home, there were 13 of our wives pregnant. We're kind of a prolific bunch of guys, I guess. We had not been to sea for so long. But out of the 13, three of us survived. And I have talked and seen some of the children of those that were lost. And it's quite touching, and they're quite interesting to know what went on, and it was very, very touching to have them come up and just talk to you.
And Pat Doohan was always willing to talk about it. He was such a great ambassador for his ship, his fallen shipmates, and the survivors of Typhoon Cobra. He never heard a sweeter Christmas carol than the ones that welcomed him aboard that hospital ship on Christmas Eve 1944. Pat passed away in 2015 at the age of 92. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And finally today, a man who earned the Silver Star in Italy. While the Battle of the Bulge was raging to the north, Allied forces were fighting the Germans in Italy as well, and that's where Alvin Pate was with the 91st Infantry Division.
We crossed the Po River, the infantry and weapons platoons, all of us on pontoons crossing the Po River. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't get our tanks with us, so we advanced to a place called Syria, Italy. And then one of the people, we call him Fascist, he came and told us, he says, you're bypassing a lot of German lines, German tanks. And I told Captain Bowling, I says, why don't we try to do something about that before dark? It's probably maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
He says, oh, that's in C Company's section. Well, they'll take care of that. But instead, they did not take care of it. So during the night, here came this bunch of German tanks. In Italy, all the entrances and the exits in the towns, there's an archway, okay?
Right.
They led with a half track. You familiar with what a half track is?
Absolutely, yes.
Because it had some a lot of power on it, or, guns.
Mm-hmm.
So we let it get right in the middle of this archway, and we dropped a phosphor shell right in the middle of it, and it burnt it to the ground. And then there was enough shells going off that we kept them from... They tried to hook a chain or cable on it to get it out of the way so they could get through with their tanks. But we kept them all night from managing to move that half track, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then during the night, one of their men came down the road waving a white flag, and I gave the orders to cease fire and let him advance. And then after he was there just a little bit, he says, "Now, can I go tell my comrades?" I said, "Oh, no, you don't. You go 50 yards up that line, and you better stay on that line, and you tell them if they want to surrender, put lace their fingers behind their head and come in a single file with no guns down that right down that line, in a single line." And he told them that, and they said, "We're not surrendering under those terms." I says, "Well, tell them they're going to die if they don't surrender." Well, they wouldn't surrender, but then he asked, "May I return to my comrades?" I says, "Oh, no, you don't. You're same as a prisoner of war right now."
So they avoided what could have been a disastrous situation there, and later Alvin Pate earned the Silver Star for rescuing fellow soldiers who had been buried by enemy artillery blasts.
I have received several letters from people that I had saved, my friends and I. Resley and I dug these men up there out of Livernano.
Yeah.
I told you that there was a large chunk of shrapnel lodged in my mess kit on my back. And Resley and I dug these men up with those artillery and rocket shells. They were firing directly in there. We dug them out, and like I said, a guy by the name of Jarvis lived, but we couldn't revive Corette, who had been my messenger up to that time.
So as you're digging him out, unbeknownst to you, you're hit by a piece of shrapnel. And when tell us how you realized that. Something felt a little different, didn't it?
Well, it was a little bit afterwards. I thought, that thing is sure heavy. And I took the combat pack and turned it around, and there, about half of it was lodged in my mess kit on my back. And that it cut a hole down, well, it cut a tree down, I'd say about 3 or 4 inches. It cut it off right at the end of a slit trench where I was at, you know.
So it was certainly enough to cut you if your mess kit hadn't been there.
Yeah. Yeah, the Lord's been good to me, like I told you. That's the reason I'm here today.
It sounds like you have a few of those moments during your time in the war where you felt someone was definitely looking out for you.
Well, yes, I know. I could feel that the Lord was with me. And that if you have the Lord on your side, you can do things that you couldn't do at all without him. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I understand that you spent a lot of time not just praying for your own survival and for your wife and baby back home, but for all the men who served under you?
Yes, I did. I prayed for my men, and I prayed for the wisdom to be able to lead them in such a way that they wouldn't get killed. You know, we had been 5 miles in advance of the main line from Livernato, and the captain asked me, says, "Do you think you could take a detail of men?" We'd been up there 30 days at that time,
mm-hmm.
back to Livernato. That was where the main line was, and pick up letters and packages for our troops that are here. I said, "Well, I can sure try, sir."
Well, why don't you tell us what day that was?
Yeah, I took 6 men. Can you believe this is in detail?
And this was Christmas Eve, 1944, right?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
So I thought the Germans may have thought more about Christmas than we thought they did. Because as we advanced, the snow was about hip deep or a little more, and I'd been leading the with the 6 men until the Germans, they closed off in front of us, and I told my men, I says, "Form a skirmish line." If you're familiar with the skirmish line, that's you spread out to where each one has a field of fire.
Right.
Okay. When the Germans seen us do that, they opened up just apart, and we went right on through. They didn't even fire on us, and we went through to Livernato, and we were loaded with mail and packages and things going back for our company, which was 200 men, you know. But, you know, we formed a skirmish line when we seen them closing off in front of us. They opened up and let us go right on through.
Now, how close would you say you were to the German soldiers? How far away were they? A matter of feet?
Maybe 50 yards.
Uh-huh.
They backed off and let us go right on through them.
Did you make eye contact with anyone?
I think, no, they didn't fire nothing on us. And we didn't fire at them. But they let us go right on through with all that mail and packages. And now, if they'd have started opening up on us, we'd had mail and packages scattered all over because we'd had to be firing, right?
You probably had would have had you laid out on the snow dead, too.
Yeah, so I saw that a lot because I thought that was kind of funny, you know, because maybe the Germans thought more about Christmas than we thought they did, huh?
Well, what did that mean to you when you, and I assume, well, I imagine that after the war you probably reflect on that, and maybe this Christmas and every Christmas you reflect on that. Did that tell you that this was about more than the hostilities, more than one man trying to kill another, and that there was a common denominator, even though you're on opposite sides of that conflict?
Well, when we were in advance of the main line, 4 or 5 miles from Livignano, the GIs, they always nickname everything, they called it the Gobbler's Knob.
All right.
Okay, they nicknamed the Gobbler's Knob, but... then Livignano itself was nicknamed by the Germans Liver and Onions. But anyway, I came through 288 days of it, and I was the only boy in our family, and someone said, well, you could have got out of it because you were the only man in the family.
Right.
I says, no, I didn't want out of it. I got in it. Only way I wanted out was to win, you know. Win the war and get it over with.
And I imagine, I've interviewed a lot of guys who lived through the Battle of the Bulge. I know how cold that winter was in 1944, but I imagine that Christmas of 1944 was probably about as memorable a Christmas as you've ever had.
I think so. I really think so, because I think we always heard that the Germans didn't believe in Christmas and stuff like that. That made me think they knew more about Christmas than we thought they did, don't you think?
Yes, and no doubt those letters from home, safely delivered to their intended recipients, brought a little Christmas cheer to weary soldiers who sorely needed it. Alvin Pate passed away in 2012 at the age of 90. Like the others you heard from today, you can access the complete original interview with him at hometownheroesradio.com. No matter how you're spending your holiday season in 2018, you're not in a Japanese prison camp, you're not being rescued at sea after surviving a typhoon that killed hundreds of your shipmates, and you're not shivering in an Italian winter thanking the enemy for letting you pass through with mail for beleaguered troops. Just a few examples of what our men and women in uniform then and now endure for the sake of our freedom. Whether you're celebrating Christmas, like my family, or another holiday, I hope you enjoy the blessings of America and remember those who put their lives on the line to preserve that privilege for the rest of us. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.